The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from The Week magazine, dated February 22nd, 2013. And as usual, we'll begin with the main story section from The Week magazine. This week it is entitled, The Search for Pope Benedict's Successor. Pope Benedict XVI stunned the Catholic world this past week by announcing that he will step down at the end of the month, setting up a struggle for succession that will determine the future course for a church plagued by scandal and shrinking congregations. As a traditionalist, Benedict delivered his resignation effective February 28th in Latin to a gathering of cardinals in Vatican City. The pontiff said he lacked the strength of mind and body to carry out his ministry in a world subject to so many changes and shaken by questions of deep relevance for the life of the faith. Benedict's decision was almost unprecedented. Celestine V, the last pope to abdicate voluntarily, quit in 1924 and surprised the Vatican. It was like a lightning bolt in a clear blue sky, said Cardinal Angelo Serrano. Those closest to the pope say he decided to resign in April following an exhausting official trip to Mexico and Cuba. He has gotten tired faster and faster, said Benedict's brother, Father George Ratzinger. A conclave to choose his successor is expected to meet in mid-March. Leading candidates for the papacy include conservative cardinals Angelo Scola of Milan and Mark Ouellet of Canada. Some Vatican watchers, however, think the time is right for a pope from the Church's new strongholds in Africa or Latin America, and have pointed to Ghana's Cardinal Peter Appiah Turkson as a possible pontiff. Now here's what the editorials had to say. Pope Benedict has been a passionate shepherd, said Newsday. In his 8-year papacy, he has embraced the Church's mission to help the poor and urged world leaders to tackle climate change. It's to his credit that he has chosen to resign at age 85 rather than remain in power, while his health and perhaps his service to the Church he has ministered to so ably declines. Benedict would have made a fine medieval pope, said the Washington Post, but he was ill-suited to the 21st century. While the rest of the world was advancing rights for gays and women, he was denouncing homosexuality as unnatural and unacceptable, and rejecting the idea of female priests as heresy. And as Catholicism's demographic center shifted to the developing world, Benedict focused on reviving the faith in Europe. He failed. Secularism advanced on the continent, while congregations in Latin America and Africa lost ground to evangelical churches. Now here's what the columnist said. If the modern world didn't like Benedict, said Timothy Stanley in CNN.com, then that's the world's problem. As a true Catholic, he made it his mission to return the Church to its core values. That's why he revived the Latin Mass and bravely defended the Church's timeless insight that sex is a holy expression of love and possible procreation in the context of marriage, but destructive when used as an instrument of selfish pleasure. Benedict's legacy is the victory of theological principle over fashionable compromise. There was nothing principled about his handling of clerical sex abuse, said James Carroll in the Boston Globe. In May 2001, then-Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger sent a confidential letter to every Catholic bishop ordering that accusations of child rape by priests be handled in the most secretive way. Anyone who went to the press or the authorities, he warned, could be excommunicated. The church can now make amends for past sins, said Christopher Moraff in PhiladelphiaMagazine.com. The conclave could elevate a cardinal from Latin America, where 42% of Catholics live, or Africa, bringing a fresh perspective to an office long dominated by old white Europeans. But wherever the Pope comes from, he will need to embrace the realities of the modern world. There's little chance of that, said Bill Keller in the New York Times. The Church has a low tolerance for dissent and will happily shed dissatisfied liberal believers in order to preserve its conservative core. It's possible that the conclave may pick a successor who is less austere and more politically adept, but 67 of the 118 cardinal electors were appointed by Benedict himself. This is not a bastion of enlightenment. Don't expect a Vatican Spring. The next item from the main story section is Obama's ambitious second-term agenda. President Obama laid out an unashamedly progressive list of priorities for his second-term agenda this past week in a State of the Union address that focused on government's role in recreating a rising, thriving middle class. The key proposals in Obama's speech included an increase in the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $9 an hour, universal pre-kindergarten schooling in every state, a jobs program to rebuild crumbling roads and bridges, and tax breaks for companies that manufacture in the U.S. He said such programs would not increase our deficit by a single dime, suggesting they could be paid for by tax reform and modest reforms to Medicare. We need a smarter government, he said, that sets priorities and invests in broad-based growth. Obama urged Congress to take action on reducing carbon emissions, suggesting he would act if lawmakers did not. He concluded with an emotional call to Congress to bring gun control legislation to the floor, including stricter background checks and a ban on high-capacity magazines. If you want to vote no, that's your choice, but these proposals deserve a vote, he said. Pointing to the various victims of gun crime seated in the House chamber, Obama repeated, "They deserve a vote," over and over as Democrats rose in standing ovation. Senator Mark Rubio of Florida, responding on behalf of the Republican Party, said Obama thought the solution to every problem is for Washington to tax more, borrow more, and spend more. Now here's what the editorial said. This was the most forceful defense of liberal values by any president since Lyndon Johnson, said the Los Angeles Times. Genuine reforms on immigration, climate change, gun control, and investment in the economy are ambitions worthy of a great nation. Despite the popularity of these common sense ideas, Republicans will reflexively oppose all of them, said the New York Times. That's why Obama has taken the fight directly to the American people. His goal is to use public opinion as a wedge to break Washington's gridlock. In his tiresome and graceless speech, Obama failed to describe the true state of our union. Broke, said NationalReview.com. Obama blithely promised that his laundry list of government handouts wouldn't add a dime to the nation's $16 trillion deficit, a laughable conceit considering he already has added some 60 trillion dimes to it. Throwing more cash at every liberal constituency in sight won't get the private sector economy going again. What the columnist had to say: Obama's proposals were ones he'd made before, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post, but the real message was in the newly reelected president's confident, challenging manner. When he called attention to a 102-year-old black voter in the gallery who'd stood in line for hours to cast her ballot, and to all the relatives of gun violence in the chamber, scowling Republicans sat on their hands and looked lost, it was exquisite political theater. exquisite, said Kyle Wingfield in AJC.com. Obama's address was nothing more than a pastiche of speeches he's given over the past 4 years. Even his gun control message, which is old preacher's trick of repeating the same phrase again and again, "they deserve a vote," will not get his proposals through the Republican-controlled House. This was just campaign rally rah-rah stuff. But we conservatives dismiss Obama's rhetorical skills at our own peril, said Pete Hegseth in NationalReview.com. He has mastered the art of grandstanding on common sense while accusing his opponents of perpetual obstructionism. As long as Republicans remain stuck in that role, Obama has the upper hand. Doesn't he know it, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. With Washington in permanent gridlock and the sequester fight looming, Obama is doubling down on the strategy he used in the election campaign, painting his opponents as crazed ideologues and tantalizing Americans with a vision of what he'd do if Congress would only let him. Put people to work rebuilding bridges, raise the minimum wage, fix Medicare, do something to reduce the casualties of our gun culture. Like most of the big political nights over the past year, this one belonged to Obama. And now from the main story section, we'll turn to the controversy of the week. It's entitled Drones, Obama as Judge, Jury, and Executioner. In his confirmation hearings last week, John Brennan perfectly articulated President Obama's justification for using drones to kill suspected terrorists, said David Rode in the New York Times. Brennan offered up lots of right-sounding assurances, but little transparency. Brennan is Obama's pick to be the next CIA director and also the architect of the controversial drone warfare program that has killed up to 3,000 people in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Yemen since Obama took office. Among those killed have been the U.S.-born al-Qaeda leader Anwar al-Awlaki, his 16-year-old son, and an unknown number of innocent civilians. Before the Senate, Brennan vigorously defended the drone program, but provided only the general reassurance that we only use these authorities and these capabilities as a last resort. That's not nearly good enough, said Glenn Greenwald in Guardian.co.uk. Like George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, Obama has deemed the entire world a global battlefield, where, according to a recently leaked White House memo, he has authority to kill anyone, including American citizens, deemed to be an associated force of al-Qaeda. No formal charge needs to be made, no trial needs to be held. Obama has claimed for himself the radical and dangerous power to act as an accuser, prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner. You civil libertarians need to climb down from your ivory towers, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. In 2001, Congress explicitly gave the president broad powers to use all necessary and appropriate force to capture or kill terrorists who murdered 3,000 Americans on 9/11 or who would attack us again. While we would prefer to see more terrorists captured and interrogated, their execution by drone strike is both legal and necessary to protect America. Obama can't send police to arrest guys like al-Awlaki in Yemen and read him his rights, said Gary Schmidt in WeeklyStandard.com. Is it really an assault on the Constitution to say that when a U.S. citizen flees the country and gets promoted to senior leader of a terrorist group, sworn to the mass murder of Americans, he has forfeited his right to a jury trial? That he has, said David Brooks in the New York Times, but still, giving any president unbounded authority to kill whomever he likes makes me nervous, especially since drone strikes are so easy, hidden, and abstract. America's founders deeply distrusted unchecked power, and for good reason. As we move uneasily into the drone age, our government needs to set up an independent judicial panel to review the kill lists. That's a very sensible precaution, said Michael Tomosky in TheDailyBeast.com, and Brennan testified that Obama is considering it. Having a secret court overseeing the drone program won't fully satisfy the critics, since there will be no public charges or trials, but it will at least satisfy the valid concern that the president alone shouldn't have such power. How times change one's perspective, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com. In 2007, then-Senator Obama lambasted the Bush administration for trampling the Constitution in the war on terrorism. The law, Obama righteously thundered, is not a subject to the whims of stubborn rulers. Justice is not arbitrary. Now that he feels the full weight of protecting the country from terrorism, Obama has adopted a view of presidential war powers that sounds quite like Dick Cheney's. This presents a real intellectual challenge to the many Democrats who view Obama as a hero, but Bush and Cheney as tyrants. How to resolve the contradiction? Easy. Conclude that they were wrong the first time. Now from the main story section, we'll turn to the popular section called The Good Week For and The Bad Week For from the Week magazine for this week. It was a good week for nervous flyers after aviation researchers declare the airline industry safer now than ever before, with the risk of passengers dying within the U.S. dropping to 1 in 45 million flights. It was a good week for the pythons after a month-long effort to rid the Florida Everglades of Burmese pythons by 1,500 gun and machete-wielding hunters ended with the capture of just 50 of the estimated 100,000 well-camouflaged wily snakes in the swamp. "I saw nothing but alligators and birds," said one frustrated hunter. And it was a good week for divine commentary. After the dome of St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican was struck by lightning twice in the hours following Pope Benedict XVI's resignation announcement. It was a bad week for really needing a drink after Senator Marco Rubio, in the midst of making the Republican rebuttal to the State of the Union address, leaned partway out of the TV frame to grab a bottle of water and take a swig. Twitter wags called it hashtag Watergate. It was a bad week for the gullible after hackers broadcast a warning through a Montana TV station's emergency alert system that the dead are rising from their graves and attacking the living. Four concerned viewers called the police to see if the zombie apocalypse was real. And it was a bad week for red meat after the most loyal customer of Las Vegas's Heart Attack Grill, home of the quadruple bypass burger, died from a heart attack at 52. Owner John Basso mourned the loss of daily burger eater John Alleman, but said it isn't going to stop us from what we're doing. People have got to live their lives. Now we'll turn to the briefing section from the Week magazine for this week, and this week's edition is entitled, "Please Turn Off Your Electronic Devices." Aviation authorities are finally considering lifting the ban on passenger use of e-readers, tablets, and other electronics. Why? Well, why is there a ban in the first place? The airline industry and the Federal Aviation Administration worry that electromagnetic waves emitted by passengers' personal electronic devices, including MP3 players, laptops, tablets, and cell phones, could interfere with an aircraft's electronic controls or avionics. Commercial pilots file dozens of reports every year detailing how their radios, GPS navigation systems, and collision avoidance boxes suddenly went haywire but began functioning again when passengers were asked to check that all their devices were turned off. That kind of circumstantial evidence led the FAA in 1993 to urge that laptops, audio players, and other electronic distractions not be used during takeoff and landing. Once an aircraft is above 10,000 feet, aviation officials say, a flight crew would have enough time and altitude to safely react to any electronic problem. The risk in allowing passengers to use their electronics at lower altitudes is tiny, said Boeing engineer David Carson, but since a freak occurrence could end in disaster, why take that risk? Is there any evidence to support this fear? It's mostly theoretical. Any electrical device can interfere as electricity flows through its wiring, but even those without wireless signals, like portable CD players, can emit potentially troublesome electromagnetic radiation. Devices that intentionally transmit radio waves, like cell phones, pose even greater problems. Some engineers think that such emissions could potentially drown out weak signals from radio navigation beacons on the ground or GPS satellites in space. Wireless industry spokesman Michael Altschul says such fears are baseless, since separate radio frequencies are assigned for aviation and commercial use. Plus, he said, the wiring and instruments for aircraft are shielded to protect them from interference from commercial wireless devices. In two decades of tests, government scientists and experts at Boeing and Airbus have bombarded planes with electromagnetic radiation, but have never succeeded in replicating the problems reported by pilots or confirmed that electronic devices caused any equipment failure. Do some flyers ignore the ban? A recent survey found that 40% of air passengers didn't bother to turn their phones off during takeoff or landing. 7% left their devices, Wi-Fi, and cellular communications functions active. And 2% surreptitiously used their phones to talk or text on board. University of Illinois psychologist Daniel Simmons estimates the odds of all 78 passengers on an average-size U.S. domestic flight powering down their phones completely as infinitesimal, less than 1 in 100 quadrillion. If personal electronics were as dangerous as the FAA rules suggest, navigation and communication would be disrupted every day on domestic flights, he said. But we don't see that. In addition, flight crews now freely use iPads in the cockpit instead of bulky paper operating manuals. And above 10,000 feet, many U.S. airlines happily allow passengers to use the Internet via onboard Wi-Fi systems for a fee, with no reports of dangerous interference with airplane avionics. Will the FAA ever ease up its rules? It's considering doing just that, as more and more people replace books and magazines with Kindles, iPads, and smartphones. Pressure is growing to lift the ban. The FAA announced last year that it would conduct a thorough review of its electronic device policy, but didn't say when that review would be completed. Senator Claire McCaskill, the Democrat from Missouri, has warned the FAA that if it doesn't soon relax its rules on e-readers and other portable electronics, she will introduce legislation forcing it to do so. I'm big on getting rid of regulations that don't make sense, she said, and I think this is one of them. When might the ban end? Conceivably within a year, although bureaucracies can move very slowly. Current guidelines require each airline to test every make and model of each electronic device it wants the FAA to approve for each type of aircraft in its fleet. But the FAA is now seeking to bring together airlines, aircraft manufacturers, technology firms, and the Federal Communications Commission to streamline the certification process for tablets, e-readers, and other gadgets so entire classes of devices could be approved at one time. The ban on using cell phones to make calls or send texts in the air, however, is likely to remain for the foreseeable future. Why single out cell phones? The trouble there is possible interference with cellular networks, not with aircraft avionics. Cell networks operate on the principle that a cell phone is only within range of one or two cellular towers. A phone that's moving at 500 miles per hour, at 30,000 feet, however, can shower signals on any number of masts, confusing the network software and potentially leading to dropped calls between land-based customers. Besides, surveys show that most passengers dread the thought of some jerk in the next seat being free to conduct annoying cell phone conversations from New York to Los Angeles. An aircraft is one of the few places left on Earth where you can actually escape from mobile phones, said aviation and travel writer Benay Wilson. I hope it stays that way. And now the footnote to the briefing section about electronic devices in the air this week is entitled Sky High Punishments. Many passengers ignore the electronics ban in flight, but those who get caught and remain defiant can pay a serious price. Actor Alec Baldwin was booted from an American Airlines flight in 2011 after he ignored a flight attendant's repeated request that he stop playing a game on his smartphone. Last November, half a dozen police cars raced onto the tarmac and surrounded a plane at New York's LaGuardia Airport as if there were a terrorist on board. They were there to arrest a 30-year-old passenger who had refused to turn off his phone during taxiing. Scofflaws on foreign flights can risk more than ejection. In 1999, oil worker Neil Whitehouse refused to switch off and hand over his phone to a British Airways flight attendant, earning a year in jail. A Saudi Arabian passenger who flouted the cell phone ban 2 years later received an even harsher punishment, 70 lashes. Now from the Week magazine for this week, we'll turn to the best columns in the United States as determined by the Week magazine editors. The first one is entitled Sympathy for a Psychopath, and it was written by Dennis Prager in NationalReview.com. A Facebook page was created to defend him. Thousands of commenters on websites and on black radio stations praised his loony manifesto and blamed the Los Angeles Police Department's racism for setting him off. It's hard to believe, said Dennis Prager, but that's how some people reacted to the killing spree by former Los Angeles cop Christopher Dorner. The rogue ex-cop, who apparently killed himself this week during a firefight with police, claimed he was taking revenge for his firing by the L.A. Police Department, which he largely blamed on racism. That led a disturbing number of people to view the killer sympathetically, as a black man with legitimate grievances that caused him to snap. Dorner merits no sympathy. He's a psychopath who murdered a cop's daughter, her fiancé, and two cops. Imagine the reaction if conservatives defended a white man who killed blacks out of racial resentment. A tsunami of vilification of conservatives and of conservative media would have ensued. Whatever led to his firing, Dorner's feelings of victimization were wildly exaggerated and can't be excused. The real victims are decomposing in their graves. The next column is entitled, When Going Green Makes People Sick, and it was written by Ramesh Panaru in Bloomberg.com. When communities like San Francisco and Seattle began banning plastic bags, said Ramesh Panaru, it seemed like a public-spirited thing to do. But benign-seeming laws often have unintended consequences, and the plastic bag ban is now producing a sickening result. The reusable shopping bags that people now use to bring groceries home turn out to be breeding grounds for bacteria carried by raw meat and unwashed vegetables. Studies have found that half of reusable bags contain coliform bacteria from feces. If these bags are left in a warm car trunk for 2 hours, the number of bacteria grows tenfold. Kind of gross, no? After San Francisco banned plastic bags, another study by two law professors found emergency room admissions caused by E. coli infections began climbing. Researchers estimate that the plastic ban leads to 5 additional deaths a year from foodborne illness. Regular washing and drying can clean out a reusable bag's bacterial colonies, but it's a habit many consumers simply don't have. It's a stomach-turning reminder that governments should just let people make their own decisions. And the third column from this week's columns that are the best in the U.S., according to The Week, is entitled The Peril of Stigmatizing Mental Illness. And this one was written by Abby Rappaport in The American Prospect. In the national debate on gun violence, the mentally ill make for easy scapegoats, said Abby Rappaport. The NRA's Wayne LaPierre has called for a national database of the mentally ill, saying it's the best way to stop genuine monsters from killing. But stigmatizing those who seek treatment is likely to backfire and make all of us less safe. Take the new law in New York that requires therapists and nurses to alert officials if they deem a patient a danger to themselves or others, so that whatever weapons they own can be confiscated. This is based on the fallacy that murderous behavior can be predicted ahead of time. It usually can't. And will people suffering from PTSD, bipolar disorder, or other forms of mental illness be more or less likely to seek treatment if doing so lands them on a government list and guarantees that cops will confiscate their guns? In most cases, it's the lack of treatment that's the best predictor of future violence. To make the country safer, we should make mental health treatment more accessible rather than punish those who seek it. And you are listening to the Reading of the Week magazine for this week, February 22nd, 2013. Thanks so much for joining me here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Now we're going to turn to The Last Word, as located near the back of the magazine in the magazine each week. And this week, the article is entitled, What is a Good Life? People pursue happiness, says Emily Efsani Smith, but it's always temporary. Pursue meaning instead. In September 1942, Viktor Frankl, a prominent Jewish psychiatrist and neurologist in Vienna, was arrested and transported to a Nazi concentration camp with his wife and parents. 3 years later, when his camp was liberated, most of his family, including his pregnant wife, had perished. But he, prisoner number 119104, had lived. In his best-selling 1946 book, Man's Search for Meaning, Frankl concluded that the difference between those who had lived and those who had died came down to one thing, meaning. As he saw in the camps, those who found meaning, even in the most horrendous circumstances, were far more resilient to suffering than those who did not. Everything can be taken from a man but one thing, Frankl wrote in the book, the last of the human freedoms to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. In his book, Frankl gives the example of two suicidal inmates he encountered in the camps. Like many others there, these two men were hopeless and thought there was nothing more to expect from life, nothing to live for. In both cases, Frankl writes, it was a question of getting them to realize that life was still expecting something from them. For one man, it was his young child who was then living in a foreign country. For the other, a scientist, it was a series of books that he needed to finish. Frankl writes, "This uniqueness and singleness, which distinguishes each individual and gives a meaning to his existence, has a bearing on creative work as much as it does on human love. A man who becomes conscious of the responsibility he bears toward a human being who affectionately waits for him or to an unfinished work will never be able to throw away his life. He knows the why for his existence and will be able to bear almost any how." In 1991, the Library of Congress and the Book of the Month Club listed Man's Search for Meaning as one of the 10 most influential books in the United States. Today, the book's ethos, its emphasis on meaning, the value of suffering, and responsibility to do something greater than the self, seems to be at odds with our culture, which is more interested in the pursuit of individual happiness. To the European, Frankl wrote, "It is a characteristic of the American culture that again and again one is commanded and ordered to be happy. But happiness cannot be pursued. It must ensue. One must have a reason to be happy." According to Gallup, the happiness levels of Americans are at a 4-year high. On the other hand, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, about 4 out of 10 Americans have not discovered a satisfying life purpose. 40% either do not think their lives have a clear sense of purpose or are neutral about whether their lives have purpose. Research has shown that having purpose and meaning in life increases overall well-being and life satisfaction, improves mental and physical health, enhances resiliency, enhances self-esteem, and decreases the chances of depression. Well, this is why some researchers are cautioning against the pursuit of mere happiness. In a new study, psychological scientists asked nearly 400 Americans ages 18 to 78 whether they thought their lives were meaningful and/or happy. Examining their self-reported attitudes toward meaning, happiness, and many other variables like stress levels, spending patterns, and having children, the researchers found that a meaningful life and a happy life overlap in certain ways, but are ultimately very different. How do the happy life and the meaningful life differ? Well, happiness, they found, is about feeling good. Specifically, the researchers found that people who are happy tend to think that life is easy. They are in good physical health and they are able to buy things that they need and want. While not having enough money decreases how happy and meaningful you consider your life to be, it has a much greater impact on happiness. The happy life is also defined by a lack of stress or worry. Most importantly, from a social perspective, the pursuit of happiness is associated with selfish behavior, being a taker rather than a giver. The psychologists give an evolutionary explanation for this. Happiness is about drive reduction. If you have a need or a desire, like hunger, you satisfy it, and that makes you happy. People become happy, in other words, when they get what they want. Humans are not the only ones who can feel happy. Animals have needs and drives, too, and when those drives are satisfied, animals also feel happy. Happy people get a lot of joy from receiving benefits from others, while people leading meaningful lives get a lot of joy from giving to others, says Kathleen Vose, one of the study's authors. In other words, meaning transcends the self, while happiness is all about giving the self what it wants. People who have high meaning in their lives are more likely to help others in need. If anything, pure happiness is linked to not helping others in need, the researchers write. What sets human beings apart from animals is not the pursuit of happiness, which occurs all across the natural world, but the pursuit of meaning, which is unique to humans, according to Roy Baumeister, the lead researcher of this study. The study participants reported deriving meaning from giving a part of themselves away to others and making a sacrifice on behalf of the overall group. Having more meaning in one's life was associated with doing activities like buying presents for others, taking care of kids, and arguing. People whose lives have high levels of meaning often actively seek meaning out, even when they know it will come at the expense of happiness. Because they have invested themselves in something bigger than themselves, they also worry more and have higher levels of stress and anxiety in their lives than happy people. Having children, for example, is associated with the meaningful life and requires self-sacrifice. But it has been famously associated with low happiness among parents, including the ones in this study. Partly what we do as human beings is to take care of others and contribute to others. This makes life meaningful, but it does not necessarily make us happy, Baumeister told me in an interview. Meaning is not only about transcending the self, but also about transcending the present moment, which is perhaps the most important finding of the study, according to the researchers. While happiness is an emotion felt in the here and now, it ultimately fades away, just as all emotions do. Positive effect and feelings of pleasure are fleeting. The amount of time people report feeling good or bad correlates with happiness, but not at all with meaning. Meaning, on the other hand, is enduring. It connects the past to the present to the future. Thinking beyond the present moment into the past or future was a sign of the relatively meaningful but unhappy life, the researchers write. Happiness is not generally found in contemplating the past or future. That is, people who thought more about the present were happier. But people who spent more time thinking about the future or about past struggles and sufferings felt more meaning in their lives, so they were less happy. Having negative events happen to you, the study found, decreases your happiness but increases the amount of meaning you have in life. If there is meaning in life at all, Frankel wrote, then there must be meaning in suffering. Which brings us back to Frankel's life and specifically a decisive experience he had before he was sent to the concentration camps. In his early adulthood, Frankel had established himself as one of the leading psychiatrists in Vienna and the world. As a 16-year-old boy, for example, he struck up a correspondence with Sigmund Freud and one day sent Freud a 2-page paper he had written. Freud, impressed by Frankel's talent, sent the paper to the International Journal of Psychoanalysis for publication. While he was in medical school, Frankel distinguished himself even further. Not only did he establish suicide prevention centers for teenagers, a precursor to his work in the camps, but he was also developing his signature contribution to the field of clinical psychology, logotherapy, which is meant to help people overcome depression and achieve well-being by finding their unique meaning in life. By 1941, he was working as the chief of neurology at Vienna's Rothschild Hospital, where he risked his life and career by making false diagnoses of mentally ill patients so that they would not, per Nazi orders, be euthanized. That same year, he had a decision to make that would change his life. With his career on the rise and the threat of the Nazis looming, Frankel had applied for a visa to America, which he was granted in 1941. By then, the Nazis had started rounding up the Jews and taking them away to concentration camps, focusing on the elderly first. Frankel knew that it would only be time before the Nazis came to take his parents away. He also knew that once they did, he had a responsibility to be there with his parents. On the other hand, as a newly married man with his visa in hand, he was tempted to leave for America and flee to safety. As Anna S. Redsend recounts in her biography of Frankel, he was at a loss for what to do, so he set out for St. Stephen's Cathedral to clear his head. Listening to the organ music, he repeatedly asked himself, "Should I leave my parents behind? Should I say goodbye and leave them to their fate?" He was looking for a hint from heaven. When he returned home, he found it. A piece of marble was lying on the table. His father explained that it was rubble of a nearby synagogue that the Nazis had destroyed. It contained a fragment of one of the Ten Commandments, the one about honoring your mother and your father. With that, Frankl decided to stay in Vienna and forego whatever opportunities for safety and career advancement awaited him in the United States. He put aside his individual pursuits to serve his family and later other inmates in the camps. The wisdom Frankl derived from his experiences there in the middle of unimaginable human suffering is just as relevant now as it was then. Being human always points and is directed to something or someone other than oneself, be it a meaning to fulfill or another human being to encounter. The more one forgets himself by giving himself to a cause, to serve, or another person to love, the more human he is. By putting aside our selfish interests and serving someone or something larger than ourselves, by devoting our lives to giving rather than taking, we are not only expressing our fundamental humanity, but are also acknowledging that there is more to the good life than the pursuit of simple happiness. And that article was copyrighted in 2013 by the Atlantic Media Company, as first published in the Atlantic Magazine. And all rights were reserved, and it was distributed by Tribune Media Services. Now, from the last word to the health and science section from the Week magazine for this week, our first article is entitled Baby Boomers Aging Badly. Thanks to medications and other marvels of modern medicine, baby boomers are living longer than their parents did. But a new study finds that they're aging in much poorer health than the previous generation. The study, based on national health surveys over two generations, found that boomers, defined as those born between 1946 and 1964, are far more likely to be obese and have diabetes, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol than their parents were 20 years ago. One reason is that they're far more sedentary. More than half of boomers reported that they don't exercise regularly, whereas only 17% of their elders said the same two decades ago. And about twice as many boomers need a cane or a walker to get around and have difficulty performing everyday tasks as members of the previous generation did. Overall, only 13% of boomers rated their health as excellent, compared with 32% of their forebears. The boomers' sorry state comes despite the fact that fewer of them smoke than their parents did, and that advances in medicine have secured them a higher life expectancy than any previous generation. Unfortunately, they may be living longer with a greater burden of chronic disease, study author Dana King of West Virginia University School of Medicine tells Time.com. It's not exactly a good public health outcome. The next item is entitled 3D Printing Stem Cells. The prospect of manufacturing new human organs with a 3D printer has come a step closer to reality, reports the Daily Telegraph in the United Kingdom. For the first time, Scottish researchers have used human embryonic stem cells, which can transform into any cell type in the body, as bio-ink in a 3D printer. Until now, the fragile cells have been unable to survive the printing process, but using a specially designed 3D printer similar to the size of a standard desktop size laser printer, researchers were able to print clusters of human embryonic stem cells in precise shapes while keeping the cells alive, says study author Will Hsu of Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh. One day, a similar method could be used to manufacture made-to-order tracheas, kidneys, or hearts. Xu and his colleagues next hope to use embryonic stem cells to print liver tissue, which has a fairly simple structure and which could be used instead of live animals to test drugs. The next item, how free love began. Americans should stop thanking or blaming the birth control pill for ushering in the sexual revolution of the 1960s and 70s. New research suggests that it was actually the use of penicillin to treat syphilis that opened a new era of promiscuity, which started a decade earlier than previously thought. In studying data about sexually transmitted diseases, Emory University economist Andrew Francis noticed that gonorrhea infections began soaring in the early 1950s, years before the birth control pill went on the market in 1960. He then found that teen pregnancies and extramarital births also rose steeply in that decade. What was prompting the behavior change? Doctors began using penicillin to treat syphilis in the mid-1940s. Up to then, fear of the disease loomed almost as large as AIDS did in 1990 because it could be fatal. Penicillin cut infection rates by 95%, and as soon as that danger was removed, Francis said there was a lot of extramarital sex going on in the backseats of lots of finned cars. The 1950s are associated with prudish, more traditional sexual behaviors. Francis tells NPR.org that may have been true for many adults, but not necessarily for young adults. And the health scare of the week, how sitting leads to infertility. Men who value their fertility should get off the sofa and head to the gym. A new Harvard School of Public Health study found that men who watched 20 or more hours of TV per week had sperm counts that were 44% lower than those of men who watched almost no TV. Meanwhile, men who exercised for 15 or more hours per week had sperm counts that were 73% higher than those of men who exercised for fewer than 5 hours per week. Researchers say exercise protects against oxidative stress, which can damage sperm cells, a benefit couch potatoes don't get. Sitting on the sofa may also be heating up your testicles for too long, which could reduce sperm count the same way that wearing tight underwear does, says Alan Pacey, a fertility expert at the University of Sheffield in the UK. Researchers caution that overdoing the exercise can backfire. Previous studies have shown that long-distance running and biking can actually reduce semen quality. My advice would be everything in moderation, says Pacey, and that includes time in the gym as well as watching TV. Now we'll turn to the Talking Points section of the Week magazine. Our first article here is entitled, Christie, Too Unfit for the Oval Office. Sort of relates to our health and science section that we just read through. Is Chris Christie too fat to be president? Asked Maureen Mackey in the Fiscal Times. Former White House doctor Connie Mariano publicly raised that question last week when she described the obese New Jersey Republican governor as a time bomb waiting to happen. The Republican physician, who served Presidents George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush, told CNN that if the popular Christie were to run for president in 2016, she would worry about this man dying in office. A furious Christie called her a hack, saying that unless she'd seen his private medical records, she should shut up. Christie claims to be the healthiest fat man you've ever seen, said Jeffrey Schweitzer in the HuffingtonPost.com. But if a man who weighs upwards of 300 pounds is healthy, he would be a medical miracle. Obesity greatly increases the risk of death by stroke, heart attack, or cancer, risks that will rise if Christie gets the nation's most stressful job. Cut the guy some freaking slack, said Michelle Cottle in the DailyBeast.com. Everyone knows that being overweight is bad for your health, But why is Christie's bulging waistline more problematic than, say, John Boehner's manic chain smoking or crazy tanning fetish? And what about all the borderline alcoholics we've elected to Congress over the years? What really is at play here is simple snobbery. Skinny coastal elites think of obesity as a disease of the lower classes and equate fatness with weakness, a lack of discipline, self-control, or character. In America, however, 2 out of 3 people are overweight, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. So Christie's weight may not trouble voters at all. In fact, the governor's extra pounds give him an everyman sort of appeal that is political gold. Christie's weight won't keep him from being elected president, said Joan Walsh in Salon.com, but his temper will. His public tirade against Dr. Mariano lasted a full minute and a half, and then he called her to berate her personally. It wasn't the first time Christie has acted like an overbearing bully. He shouted at constituents who dared question his policies and called reporters stupid and idiot for asking simple questions. There's a lot to like about the hard-working political maverick, but his rage and lack of self-control will be his undoing. Ironically, for a guy who's famous for his size, his biggest problem is being thin-skinned. And now a few short items from the Talking Points section as we reach the end of our program. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the CIA all backed a plan to arm the Syrian rebels in 2012, Panetta said at a Senate hearing last week. The plan was vetoed by President Obama, who did not want the U.S. to get more deeply involved in that crisis. Virginia's legislature has passed a new voter identification law that eliminates the use of Social Security cards or utility bills as proof of identity, but accepts gun permits. Since 1952, only one Democratic presidential candidate, Lyndon Johnson, has won a majority of the white vote. Hubert Humphrey, George McGovern, Jimmy Carter, and Walter Mondale all received lower percentages of the white vote than Barack Obama's 39% in 2012. And our poll watch for this week, 56% of Americans support drone attacks targeting terrorists, but 53% say they're very concerned about whether the drones endanger civilian lives, and 65% are very or somewhat worried about drone attacks that they could lead to retaliation from extremists. 57% are worried that the attacks will damage America's reputation abroad. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long, until next time.